Welcome to the Beekeeper's Corner Podcast.
April 10th, 2017, episode 108. It's enzymatic. Hello and welcome everyone to our ongoing pitter-patter about beekeeping. It was a glorious 80-plus degrees here in New Jersey for the first time in April, and since our last get-together, the forsythia has bloomed. There are flowering trees in New Jersey, and several of the trees are budding and blooming outside, literally as I record. I'm happy that you've taken the time to stop by and listen in. In case you didn't know, I am Kevin England, and my plan is to spend an hour or so with you, if you'll have me. And as usual, I have quite a few topics in the queue for this go-round. Oh, and no singing this episode, but you know, I didn't think I sounded half bad in that last one, but of course, I'm no Huey Lewis. Ah, Kevin moment. Maybe that could be my drinking game phrase. You have to take a shot every time I mention Huey Lewis. End of Kevin moment. So topics, let's see. Segment one will be What's in Your Honey? A Journey to the Start of a Worker Bee. Melissa Pollenology. Easy for you to say. How do you take your hive? Gotta hand it to marigolds. The seeds we sow, considering treatment options, decisions. And the last thing on the stack, a short feature on a new hive design that's making the rounds. That's a lot to cover in 75 minutes, so let's not dilly-dally. To the local hive report. Oh, by the way, I'm in one of those moods. Yeah, we're going to have fun. Local hive report. I know it's warm outside, but I still have not been inside my hives. I was out of the area at a funeral all day Saturday and had a list of honeydew tasks that kept me occupied on Sunday from morning until dark. The bees, unfortunately, are going to have to wait. I'm literally getting a break at work, and hopefully that trend will continue so I can catch up. And to that end, my plan is to take a day off on Friday, my first vacation day of the year. And my intention is to do two things that I love. Friday will be a full shakedown of the bees, given the temps will be amenable for a full inspection. And Friday night, we're heading out with the race teams to an extra distance race at Lindus Speedway in Pennsylvania. You know, I'm not sure it gets any better than that for a day's itinerary. Oh wait, did I say that my darling Honey is off this week and she's even going to the races with us on Friday? Double bingo, baby! So, I have looked in on the hives from the exterior, and they're really active. It's still cool at night, 36 degrees this morning at 5 a.m., but the forecast for the next several days, and several days in a row, more importantly, is 60 to 70 degree temperatures. So, I think it's finally a good time to get my bee mojo on and see how strong my hives are going into the 2017 spring ramp-up. My first intention is to do an inventory of hive conditions and see how strong the colonies are. I'll be looking for signs of drones, which means swarming is coming in the future, assessing the brood and the queen viability, and generally looking to see how big and where the clusters are. It's been such a topsy-turvy year that honestly, I'm not sure what to expect. My guess is they'll be moderate to strong, and they've really been hammering the last couple days. Well, strong, at least my ego wishes that they're going to be strong, and I'm hoping that we're heading to the ability to make some splits, which is my goal here in the early spring. I also intend to do some mite checks and figure out where my thresholds are, and I'll take some time later in the episode to talk about mite management and what I plan to do about it if thresholds indicate there is a reason to be concerned. With the anticipated goodness of digging into the hives for the first time this season comes the dreaded tasks of hauling in the carcasses of the losses. I hope to take the time for decent forensics on what I find and see what I can learn beyond the basic assessments that I had talked about in earlier episodes. So the local hive report, this should be the last shallow one for a while as love is in the air. Oh, I mean the season is upon us. But really, harps should be playing, and there should be sweet, sappy, upbeat Karen Carpenter melody playing while the birds tweet out happy songs. Can you tell I'm happy for spring? Local hive report, check. Let's get to segment number one. Segment number one, what's in your honey? I found myself recently on a website with a quiz about beekeeping and decided to see how I measured up. One of the questions I got wrong concerned how to test honey for pureness. I answered look for amino acids, and I should have answered enzymes. I suppose I might have known that, but then again, I have no practical experience with this, so how would I know? I have always learned that you could tell real honey by looking for traces of pollen, not enzymes, so I learned something new, or as it goes, probably learned it again since I forgot it from some time I was exposed to it in the past but didn't really retain it. That's the beauty of being able to go back and listen to my podcast, which is the whole reason we did it in the first place. So my answer was tied to the concept that it was proteins, and specifically plant proteins, that led me to my answer, which made me think amino acids. As it turns out, enzymes are complex proteins formed in living cells that bring about the many processes and reactions in living materials. How do I know that? I found a guide at honey.com that tells me so. I've always had this bent that honey is better for you and for bees than cane sugar because of what it has, what's in it. This notion of enzymes are some of the underlying differences. Coupled with trace minerals and the contamination of pollen while being processed and stored in the hive by the bees, honey is, in my mind, simply better. The guide that I found says, enzymes are complex proteins formed in living cells that bring about the many processes and reactions in living materials. Honey naturally contains small amounts of enzymes. The predominant enzymes in honey are diatase, invertase, and glucose oxidase. Others, including a catalase and acid phosphatase, easy for me to say, can also be present. Honey's enzymes content can vary widely by floral source and region. It goes on to say, and what is important to the question that I got wrong, that honey's enzymes make it a unique ingredient, far more complex than other sweeteners. A moment ago, I rattled off a few enzymes. There's a function to the enzymes, and in honey, they listed 8 of them in the guide. Diatase, amylase, is the first one. It transforms starches to other carbohydrates. Invertase, sucrase, sucrose hydrolase, and saccharase converts sucrose to glucose and fructose. They invert the sugar. Glucose oxidase converts glucose to gluconolactone, which in turn yields gluconic acid and hydrogen peroxide. You know, somewhere in the nether reaches of my mind, this triggered a response, a poke in the brain. And I figured it out. This enzyme has a little to do with how honey lasts forever. And it reminded me of the coverage we did in the second segment of episode 64, where we talked about how honey can last forever. So from that episode, I'm going to go back to the Wayback Machine. This is what we had to say on that. There's another important thing in play that keeps honey from spoiling, and that is its acidity. One of the reference articles I reviewed had this to say about honey acidity. Its average pH is around 4. This acidity is contributed to by a number of acids, including formic acid and citric acid. But the dominant acid is gluconic acid, produced by the action of bee enzymes on some of the glucose molecules in the honey. This further boosts honey's antibacterial properties
as many bacteria thrive in neutral rather than acidic conditions.
Hydrogen peroxide is also produced by the production of gluconic acid. This, too, can inhibit the growth of bacteria. So how about that? I remembered that part and went back and found it for you. That's kind of cool. So I was on the run of enzymes. Let me come back to the rest of them. Additional enzymes are catalase. It converts peroxide to water and oxygen. Acid phosphatase. This removes phosphate from the organic phosphates. And the last one is esterase, breaks down the ester bonds. Now, anybody who's a science and math and biology and whatever whiz that it takes to know these names, if I pronounced them wrong, please don't get upset with me. I did the best I could to make them sound confident. There's one more. Glucosidase converts beta glucans to oligosaccharides and glucose. Yeah, so those are the enzymes. I'm glad I'm through with that. So the answer to the question I tried to answer can be remembered, I suppose, by how these enzymes got into the honey in the first place, which is actually the more important thing for you to remember. In the collection, storage, and consumption of honey, things happen that influence the trace amounts of these enzymes being there. The guide indicates that they do not influence the final food products because they are in, quote, relatively low concentrations, end quote. However, CSI fans can use these as one avenue to determine if honey is honey by checking to see if these enzymes are present. As an example of how enzymes get into honey, diatase, the first one that was on my list, it's found in the nectar that the bees collect, and it's also added by the bee during collection and ripening of nectar. Its amount in fresh honey varies, and it also varies by the floral source and processing of the bees, but it should be present simply because the bee touched the nectar that was eventually ripened into honey, and therefore it's going to be present in honey, but not adulterated sugars. So does that make sense? It's only going to be there if their bee was involved. If it's a regular sugar, there's none of this stuff. So glucose oxidase is another enzyme in honey that originated from the bees. Invertase, the enzyme that hydrolyzes sucrose to fructose and glucose, is added to the nectar by the bees to break it down, and it's part of the formation of nectar to honey. The reaction is a key step in the ripening of nectar and is responsible for the most chemical changes of the nectar in becoming honey. So these enzymes are really important. There's so much conjecture these days about 100% pure honey. Adulterated versions come from near and far, and the inspection for pollen that I mentioned is not always possible given how filtered store-bought honey is. So why doesn't the commercial honey producers back off on filtering and heating, which in turn kills some of these enzymes? The first thing is they want to prolong the liquid state of honey. Honey that crystallizes befuddles users who don't understand that with some gentle heat, it would return back to liquid. They don't want crystals. In fact, people throw honey out because it crystallizes and they think the honey is bad. So producers pasteurize the honey in one of two common ways. They flash heat it to 170 degrees for a few seconds, or they hold it for a period of at least 30 minutes at 145 degrees. Once heated, the crystals will dissolve, and it should knock out any of the yeast cells which could be present and lead to fermentation if the honey wasn't processed correctly. And presuming that commercial operators do this because they can't take the chance on that. After pasteurization, honey is filtered under pressure to remove any remaining crystallization, air bubbles, pollen grains, or foreign product that could be found in the honey and be unappealing or lead to crystallization. All it takes is little crystals or foreign products for the crystals to form on them. So this filtering steps remove the telltale pollen, which of course is another indicator of real honey, and I think probably a better clue of the honey because it could tell you the actual plant origin. Diatase, glucose oxidase, invertase, and the other enzymes that are present in raw honey are impacted by typical processing methods that we just reviewed. Diatase is an enzyme that has been used as a marker for how much honey is heated, but because the traces of enzymes vary widely in honeys, they cannot be used consistently to tell how the honey has been kept and stored. You might think, well, if honey has been heated or stored in hot conditions, then it should have low enzymes. Actually, it might have had low enzymes because it simply started with low enzymes. It did not get stored in a hot warehouse and decompose. So this becomes tricky, right? And you can tell why people have such a hard time trying to verify, given commercial processing of honey, that it is real honey. Which is a real bummer because then people are cutting honey and making it not honey. So the one takeaway from this is storing your honey in a hot place is not so good a lot. As an aside to the enzyme conversation, honey.com says if you want to store your honey for the best outcome, keep it at least 50 degrees Fahrenheit or lower. As honey starts to darken, lose its flavor and aroma when stored at higher temperatures, and ideally below 32 degrees Fahrenheit would be best to preserve aroma, flavor, and color of unprocessed honey. Didn't know that. I knew 50 degrees, but I didn't know that cold. Back to the point of the segment, enzymes are in raw honey. If you see the question about how to tell, enzymes is the answer. As far as the quiz, which was a Master Beekeeper test quiz, I got a 72. I think I did okay, but I'm not ready, as it were, to head into the Master Beekeeper's exam and think I could pass it. Look for our show notes, as they have links, to the enzymes of honey and shelf life and stability of honey documents available that support this episode's segment. You could visit our website at bkcorner.org and check out the show notes for episode 108. Also, while I'm at it, if you have any questions, comments, think I'm just too entirely goofy, which is possible some nights, send me a note, Kevin at bkcorner. Actually, I really don't want hate mail. I just prefer you to tell me how you're doing, what you're up to, how your bees are, what's going on in your neck of the woods. Just make sure you tell me how to pronounce your name. All right, cool. Segment one all done. Let's head on to segment number two. Segment number two, worker bees. This is a time of the year where, for us in the U.S., we're seeing large growth of colonies, and I wonder, do we ever stop to consider and appreciate the beginning stages of life for the honeybee? As we all know, bees transform from an egg to an adult, and beginning larva structures, the grub, and initial worm body structures are broken down and transformed into the adult exoskeleton and body part structures of the adult. We referred to this in the episode where we talked about fat bodies and the talk given by Samuel Ramsey from the Philly Symposium a few weeks back. I found that notion interesting and wanted to revisit that and explore what exactly happens and how does it go down. Let's tackle that in a little journey from egg to emergence. I'm going to cover these in stages, and we'll start with the egg stage. Honeybees begin their life as an egg, one that it's about the diameter of a paperclip and about 3/50ths or 6/100ths of an inch long. That's 1.7 millimeters for those who are inclined to the metric system. The egg is laid standing on end and is attached to the cell by a mucus strand with its tail end down. Eggs are laid by the queen with one important distinction. They are fertilized or they are not fertilized. As humans, if a freshly laid egg was taken out of a cell and placed in a petri dish, We could not discern under a microscope if it was to be a worker or a drone. But the bees somehow can. When the egg hatches, or the proper term is to eclose, it is dependent upon the temperature of the brood nest and the genetic makeup of the population. On the term eclose, technically bees eclose. They do not hatch, as there is no membrane rupture. If I draw an analogy to a chicken egg, it has a shell, as we all know, and when a chicken hatches, it breaks through its shell. When comparing that idea to what happens with the bee membrane, which for all intent and purposes is like a chicken shell, melds into the larva as the outer membrane starts to dissolve and is eventually consumed as food by the larva. During its developmental stage, an egg is visited thousands of times by an adult nurse bee, and food is deposited in the cell and could be noted that it is not fed directly. The egg is fed lavishly for the first 24 hours, and it gets little food after that. During this period, it starts out as a cytoplasm, a nucleus, and a yolk, but by the third day prior to eclosing, it has formed into an embryo with a head and body segments. The larval stage. The egg ecloses, or hatches in air quotes, when 72 to 84 hours old and enters into the larval stage. If one could sit and observe this, they would see an egg that would be seen to have muscular contractions where the embryo moves in a weaving motion to form a tear in the outer membrane and eclose. It will then move about until it achieves an arch shape, which is referred to as the croquet wicket stage, or the familiar C shape, presumably because it looks like a croquet wicket. Kevin Moment, croquet wicket. What the heck is that? Why did someone associate this for perpetuity to the oddball reference? In the game of croquet, you know, the solid little balls hit with mallets in the grass. You try to hit the ball through that little wire hoop or croquet wicket. So, yeah, the larva in its shape resembles that thing. This is what the scientist who was trying to describe the shape came up with from the Carl Hayden Research Center, and it was referenced often in text and books. So we refer to it forevermore as looking like a croquet wicket. Okay. What an arcane reference. End of Kevin Moment. The stages of development, a quick primer. In the larval stage, the developing bee is referred to as being a ferret pupa. Ferret refers to the insect inside the cuticle of the previous development stage waiting to emerge. The egg will close and then transform from a ferret pupa to a ferret adult. I'll give you a layman's description of that so you can imagine what I'm talking about. In the egg stage, it looks, of course, like an egg. By the way, if you've ever looked at it, it's teeny tiny in a cell. Looks like a small grain of rice. In the larva stage, it looks like a little white pudgy grub. In the ferret pupa stage, it starts to change from a wormy-looking grub to a pupa and develops what will become the head and body parts. In the pupa stage, it looks like a mold of what will be a bee but has little distinguishing features. In the ferret adult stage, the eyes, legs, and other parts form to what will be the final product, a worker, drone, or queen. In this case, I'm following the life cycle of a worker. So let's talk about development timeline overview. There's a typical timetable of events during the stages of development, and I'll take you through the pattern of growth from egg to emergence. Days 1 through 3, the bee is in the egg stage. Day 4, it's in the first larval stage and has its first molt. Day 5, it's in the second larval stage and has its second molt. Day 6, the third larval stage and the third molt. Day 7, the fourth larval stage and the fourth molt, all right in a row. Around the eighth day, the cell containing the worker larva is capped. Day 9 is gorging, or the sealing stage. The larva spins a cocoon using silk from a special gland in its head. On day 10, it stretches out on its back with its head towards the cell opening and becomes quiet inside the cocoon. The time here is usually called the pre-pupa stage. Day 11 is the fifth molt, and at this point, the larva is still white in color. On day 13, color starts to gradually develop in the eyes. Day 15, the pupa stage begins and the color starts to develop around the abdomen area. Day 16, the legs start to form. Day 18, the wings. And on day 20, and with little time to spare, the antenna form. The process ends on day 21 with the sixth molt and imago. The legs, wings, and mouth parts are free, and the final and fully developed adult will begin emerging from the cell by chewing through the capping. When the bee emerges, it is likely that it will have a short period of time for final development where its exoskeleton will harden off if it's not completed already after the final molt. Imago. I mentioned that on the 21st day there is the sixth molt and imago. In entomology, the term imago means the final and fully developed adult stage of an insect, typically winged. So the worker bee goes through all these molts. As you heard in the overview, developing bees will molt six times during their development. When the molting occurs, the skin splits over the head and slips off the posterior end of the larva. This process normally takes something like 30 minutes or so. It's not instantaneous. I want to take a moment and talk about the cocoon. Not much is ever said in the descriptions you find about the cocoon of a honeybee, but if you've ever melted wax, it's clear that there are these little cups that are left behind, and they're capsules of long-discarded cocoons. So I wanted to take a little look into that, and here's what I found. Honeybees create insoluble filament from an aqueous protein solution in the spinning of silk from a spinneret drawn away from the cell wall. The silk is generated from a combined labium hypopharynx gland as the larva perform random head movements in all directions whilst moving in slow somersaults within the cell. It might take up to 48 hours for the formation of this final cocoon. It could be added that there are other excretions added to the cocoon formulation, but for now I'm not going to go into that detail because it has little to do with waste, which is something I'll talk about in a second. Yes, I mean that kind of waste. We all know that cells are made from wax and honeycomb, but you know, we never take time to consider that over time brood comb becomes modified by the addition of silk and propolis as they continue to lay, you know, more and more generations of brood in the creation of bees. This is an interesting aspect when considering the older comb that we have and how hard and rigid it becomes over the years. It's not that soft and pliable wax that was formed in the beginning of any frame at its outset. So as an aside, I found an interesting article on the topic of cocoons, and I think I'll leave the exploration of honeybee silk as an episode for another day and plow ahead to the next thing to talk about is waste. If you think about it, one of the things that we said with the development of a bee involves a large consumption of food. Where food goes in, it must come out. So what happens to that? During the time of development, the developing honeybee has a principal function of eating. Both the malpighian tubules, analogous to human kidneys, and midgut are shut off from the intestine until the larvae is nearly mature. Body wastes are stored internally, and the food surrounding each of the larvae is protected from fecal contamination. The feces are expelled at some point and pushed down to the bottom of the cell about the time the cocoon is made and after the larvae have finished eating. This is what I was alluding to a second ago. What they say is that part of the fecal matter and excretions out of the anal part of the larva become somewhat part of the glue that holds the cocoon together. So it's not just about silk. It's about other mixtures that go in that create. Yeah, not too appealing, but it's an interesting note. Along the way of becoming a bee, sometimes one has to consider what I'll call the sad path. A queen will lay an egg, and on most occasions it'll be looked over and looked after until it emerges. But there are times for the greater good of the colony that its existence will end soon after it was deposited. Firstly, bees under observation have been seen consuming eggs if need be for extra protein when resources are scarce and new bees are not needed. Secondly, sometimes they are removed when problems occur. As an example, eggs are best groomed in a brood chamber maintained at a little over 94 degrees Fahrenheit. Temperatures lower than this can result in reduced egg hatching or eclosion, and temps below 86 degrees only see a success rate of 1% of the honeybee eggs eclosing. So do consider this, by the way, when you're thinking about opening hives in early season. As you heard me in the local hive report, I had this notion in the back of my head that people are going, why didn't you get in your hives yet? It's this. So as we know, sometimes things happen to larvae and developing bees, and that causes workers to mark the capping, and eventually a house bee will come along and extract the developing bee, and in the course of proper hive maintenance, just discard it. Sometimes they're removed, and in observation hives I have seen, sometimes they're partially consumed, and you'll see them just tear the bee larva to shreds, and then you'll see them carrying what is the outer skin, basically, and anything that's left. So let's switch to the happy path. You know, I hate to end this little review on a downer, so I'll say that we know, of course, that thousands of bees are produced a day during the productive season, and the likely journey for an egg is a happy one, as it will be blissfully consume food provided and begin its transformation to the lovely girls we adore all summer. Hope you enjoyed this little foray. I always think it's kind of cool to delve into this stuff and get to know a little bit more. I'm sure there's other data that I missed, but that was a neat little journey, wasn't it? I'll provide some additional notes in the show notes if you wanted to follow this in a little more detail. There was stuff that I left out, but you could certainly go and check that out. Time to head to the back of the book. Roundtable number one. I have a term for this episode, Melissa Pollenology. Yeah, Melissa Pollenology. I bet you could tell I practiced that. Spelled MelissaPollenology. Melissa Pollenology is the study of honey. By extension, it also includes the study of any pollen contained in the honey, as well as the pollen source. You see what I did there? I drew that in with the previous segment. As we discussed in segment one, it is possible to gain evidence of the geographical location and genus of the plants that the honeybees visited by inspecting the pollen it contains. It could be noted that honey could also have pollen and spores that are attracted by the electrostatic charges of a bee doing its thing, and therefore we get swept along into the honey by way of unintended consequence, but it's probably more likely that trace pollen in honey comes from the visit of plants by the bee. Generally, Melissa Pollenology is used to combat fraud and inaccurate labeling of honey. Information gained from the study of a given sample of honey and its pollen content is useful when substantiating claims of a particular source of the sample. Another thing the study of honey helps to decide is if the honey is of literal single source or not. Monofloral honey derived from one particular source plant may be more valuable than honey derived from many types of plants.
So one last thing is the study of honey can lead to clues as to region of origin, something important in the identification of honeys around the world. Melissa Pollenology, cool word, and very apropos for our episode. And not for nothing fun to say. It's almost like supercalifragilistic, but for beekeeping. Melissa Pollenology. Yeah. Round table number two. How do you take your hive, warm or cold? An odd question to ponder and probably a foreign concept to us Americans. I ran across this tidbit in English, as in from England, description of how to add a nuke to a full-size colony. There was a particular sentence that said you had to decide if you were going to load the frames the warm or cold way. I binged the topic and wondering if I was ever going to find a reference to such an esoteric phrase, and darn if the archives of David Cushman's site didn't have an explanation. It seems that the British standard hives are square, so in practice you could set the entrance to face forward or to the side. It doesn't matter. You see, the frames could be loaded perpendicular to the entrance, referred to as the cold way, or parallel to it, which of course makes it the warm way. It's an interesting aspect of a hive configuration that honestly I've never given much thought about, and I love to talk about hive designs. I do follow a practice, if possible, of always approaching the hive from the back left side and count off my frames from 1 at the near wall to 10 at the back wall. In this way, you might approach the frame 1 from the side of the box or from the back. Another consideration is that in the cold way, all hive frames are perpendicular to the entrance. Every frame has equal access to the lower edge of the box, while in the other configuration, only frame 10 is adjacent to the entrance, and this would seem to imply a handful of notions to consider. So I don't know, did I explain that well? In one way, every edge of the frame is facing the entrance. On the other way, the sheet, the side of a frame, is facing the entrance and all the other frames are behind it. Does that make sense? So for one, think about it. The airflow into the hive could be impacted by the way the frames face the entrance. Second, think about the defense of the hive, and it could be impacted by the access of the bees to have access to the entrance, and by the means in which they have to travel to get out in the course of alarm. So I think in a situation where all the hives are set like a Langstroth hive, all the frames I mean, all the bees could just come down the bottom of the frame and out they go. But if they were stacked the other way, they would all have to come to the bottom and then traverse across to get to the entrance. They don't have easy access to just dart out of the hive. So another consideration is that it might make the front frame, the one that's all by itself facing the entrance because it's perpendicular to the entrance, cooler in the summer because of the airflow, and cold in the winter because it's near the entrance. That makes sense too? Think about that. One frame is closer to the entrance than all the others. So when the cold air is coming in the entrance, it's being hit by that. And I would think that bees might come forward in the summer to that frame, and in the winter retreat to the back of the box to get away from the entrance. And that could in turn lead to making them change how they store resources in the hive. Isn't that interesting? That's an interesting idea to me. So I have no experience with a national hive. Perhaps I'm going to have to get one to play around with, because I like to play around with different hives. And so much fun. So much fun to play around. And so little time. I will certainly have a link on the show notes to David Cushman's page on cold or warm placement of beehive frames. Round table number three, nitrile stand-in. I mentioned in the last episode that I wrote a feature on my blog for the category of what do I use. It was on protective gear, jackets, veils, and gloves.
I went in this week and tweaked a section in there to add a comment about the use of nitrile gloves, and specifically a note that I had for a while now from listener Dawn Rigby. Dawn mentioned in a note to me that in the UK they have dishwashing gloves which have the moniker marigolds, presumably because they're the color of marigolds and similar to the ones that we have in the US, which tend to be marigold colored. I'm thinking that I mentioned this, meaning the marigold gloves, on a past episode, but this seems topical given the What I Use segment. So her tip was, she uses a set of gloves for each hive and then turns them inside out after each use. She'll don, or put on, one pair for one hive, then another for hive two, and so on until she's done. At the end of her hive management routine, she takes the inside-out gloves into the house, turns them right side out, and cleans them in very hot soapy water. With this, she's able to reuse them, which I think is brilliant, as I hate the waste factor for nitrile gloves. And it seems they're resilient enough to hamper stings, and this is a better environmental approach than throwing out all nitrile gloves. Right? So I don't know if this is the first time I ever mentioned it or happens to be the second time I'm repeating it. But again, thanks, Dawn, for the tip. You know, I think I'm going to give them a try. I found them on Amazon for a little less than $8 for a pair. I don't know if that's a good price or not, but for the price of experimenting, I'm going to try them out. And I'm going to place an order and see how they hold up. They appear to be the color of marigolds, and they're the brand Marigold, so maybe they're the same ones that you could buy in the UK. I'll provide a link in the show notes to the Amazon ones that I found. I'm hoping they're big enough. I have really big paws, really big hands, and one of the problems I have with gloves is it's very hard to find a size that fits me, but it looks like there's different sizes there. So I don't typically wear gloves, but for science, I think I'll try a pair of these out and see how good they are. And maybe I can add additional information in the What I Use about these. Roundtable number 4, the seeds we sow. Wanted to follow up that I got the wildflower seed mixes from the two sources I sent in for. Bentley Seeds provided a sample pack in a very nice box. It came with a packet of bee feed mix that I had sent for. And there were some other package envelopes, sand seeds, included presumably for one to get a sense of the products that they offer. I received the packages, not the seeds, for Forest Lawn. They had forget-me-nots on the cover. One called Fresh Epcot. That's a wildflower mix, but didn't say what was included in the package. I'm guessing that you could find the information on their website as to what's in each of these mixes. There was a tomato seed pack, milkweed, popcorn seeds, spruce tree, pink cosmos, and marigold packet examples in the box. And there were also two seed discs in the box. The other seed packet that I got in the mail was from the General Mills Cheerio offer. It came in a simple envelope that had the Vessi Seed Company Honey Nut Cheerios branded logos on the packet. I decidedly do not have a green thumb. In fact, I was going to go out today and plant these, and Sharon said to me, no, don't plant them yet. There's still a chance for frost, and you have to wait till Mother's Day, and then you can plant them, because I would have been out scratching. So I heard some rumblings and backlash from the General Mills campaign online. And it was about the seeds contained some invasive species in the mix. In some retrospects, I find it an interesting twist that a company which has customers across the entire North American continent and is in the cereal business now has to consider the implications of plant origin and the fact that they're offering non-native plants to areas that don't have forget-me-nots, as an example. They partnered with Vessi's, a seed company that's been selling seeds for 75 years, and my thought is, there's nothing stopping someone in Canada from ordering these seeds online and putting them in the yard because they're pretty. I've always had a lot of leniency toward this type of thing, because of my personal ignorance, be the first to admit. I hear so much about invasive plants like Japanese knotweed and how evil it is, but I know that behind the scenes, beekeepers simply adore the plant because its abundance of forage for bees, and it also blooms at a time when things are generally not blooming. So invasive or not, we subversive beekeepers love some of these plants that provide forage for us. So there are certain plants, of course, that I know matter. For example, one might not want to plant certain bamboo plants, lest to deal with the wrath of something that's near impossible to eradicate. And farmers planted multiflora rose as hedgerows for fields, and this stuff is really challenging to get rid of and pops up often when a field is left fallow. So the field next to me, if they do nothing, within a month, there's multiflora rose sprouting all over the place. How it's got to be in the soil or whatever. Even though they spray that field every year with Roundup, if you left it be for a period of time, multiflora rose would be blooming. So I'm saying these things about these invasive plants because I'm not insensitive to the invasive angle, but I have varying layers of reaction and feel sometimes, like a lot of plant people even, that there are gray areas. These plants that people are calling out from the seed packets, from what I gather, are forget-me-nots, blue flax, and lavender. I think that's specifically the... I'm talking about the Cheerios ones. So I'm betting that I could go to 10 out of 10 garden centers within 10 miles of my home and buy forget-me-not packets if the place, the nursery, sells seed packets. I'm betting. Does that mean it's a good idea for all the North America continent to be getting these? Probably not, I suppose. But again, you could go on the internet and order whatever you want. And as far as these invasive or non-native plants in some small way, I'll tee up a rationalization. If we do the math, we have invasive plants which people worry about, and with good reason, given need to ensure that proper native plants stay solvent. Hey, you could look anywhere alongside a roadside or whatever, and all of a sudden you see this grove of bamboo or ivies or even stuff like clematis. I don't know if it's natural, but it just, honeysuckle takes over things. So I can, again, I'm trying to say I grasp the concept of some of these plants don't belong or cause harm. Then we have Roundup, sprayed on acres and acres of fields from edge to edge, killing any weeds. Oh, and native plants, but I guess that's okay. We have homeowners spraying Roundup and other methyl ethyl death far and wide. And we have municipalities and governments cutting every inch of roadside, save for some token wildflower programs that seem to sprout up here and there in our travels. We spread salt and other chemicals on the roads, which does such a number on any margin plants alongside the roadways. And homeowners have lush green lawns taken care of by lawn care companies that roll up with big tanks of chemicals and fertilizers. So, man, social media is right. General Mills should be crucified for invasive species being in the wildflower mix. Is it me? I'm kind of missing the point, folks. I find more and more, and if you get tired of listening to me, sorry, but I get into these vortexes once in a while with this line of thinking. But sometimes the way these things come out, it defies logic for me, and I get mad as hell, and I'm not going to take it anymore. And yeah, I'm accused of being a shill for big ag and chemical-dependent junkies, and for those that take issue, take solace that I simply tell you what I do. And you're free to dislike that, but you're also of free will and could do as you please. So if you don't want to put invasive non-native plants, don't put the seed packet in your yard.
So if I were General Mills, I would do what they did. They offered up a response statement that said, quote, in most locations, the seed mixture species will be non-native but considered invasive. They trusted their supplier, who stated in their response that they were fully compliant with the Canada Seed Act. So I'm inferring perhaps the complaints originated north of our border. I'm not sure. Perchance with visibility, General Mills will tweak the program should they come back next year, and they'll obviously be a wiser company on how to do it. So for those that still think they did wrong, my suggestion is head down to the nursery and buy local plants to do your part. As for me, I'm going to go back out in my backyard like thousands and thousands of dumb Americans and find a home to scratch the dirt for my seed mixtures. So forgive me if you think less of me. And I simply want to say thanks to General Mills and Bentley Seeds for the generous programs that support pollinators. By the way, Cheerios had a goal to give out 100 million seeds, and they distributed 1.5 billion. Sorry if you're still looking, their program is closed. Round table number 5, 2 to go. Considering treatment options. I'm going to come back to my commentary from the local hive report. As we roll to the middle of April, it begs the question of the management practices of bees as foraging starts to become widely available here in the Mid-Atlantic region. It has been, in my estimation, too cold to go into the hives. I crack them open, as you heard in the local hive report from the previous episode, but I have not done my first full inspection, which comes on Friday. So common wisdom has shifted these days in this region to considerations for mite monitoring and treatments, if you are of that sort, and early prior to ramp up of full nectar flow is the time to do it. Some of my beekeeping friends have treated already. I would say it's about a ratio of 30% to 70%. With the lesser number having treated for mites, given notions of knocking down phoretic mites, those are the ones on the bees, now and before large amounts of brood get capped. The news about that is, you get the mites coming out of winter, you have really healthy bees going into the nectar flow. So it leaves me a little late in some respects to that 30%, and I wrestle with the balance of leaving the hives alone and not breaking the propolis seals to the notion of maybe I should have been monitoring and treating my bees already to make them as healthy as possible for the nectar flow to come. I've spent a considerable amount of angst and energy thinking about treatment options should my mite checks warrant doing something. I anticipate that with the onset of warm weather, remember the forecast is for 70 degrees this week, I could do mite checks and then accordingly, and if needed, treatments. And the question is what product to use. Some beekeepers have treated with Apivar early in the season, even as early as March 1st, from what I understand. I did some treatments in the fall using Apivar, and I didn't want to use the same product again. As I just stated, I also didn't want to open my hives, which was my personal preference. So now I find myself going in where I have brood formed. And on March 1st, I probably would have had all open comb and not a lot of sealed brood. So perhaps I'll learn this year that I would have been better off breaking the seals in March. But for now, I'm going a different path, which is to only open the hives when it gets warm. My logic to this, by the way, is when it's warm, the bees can repair the damage that I've done by sealing the hives, as they'll have plant materials available for them to do so. When it's too cold and they can't go out and forage or they can't manipulate the hive, how do they seal the hive back up? So when I break the seals, I only pop the lid off and then I put it back but I didn't break between all the boxes. Not much of a distinction, but a distinction anyway.
So what to do? And having the notion that the bees will very soon, if not already, begin to collect nectar for honey that I want to possibly harvest. I think for the first time in my beekeeping career, I'm going to consider Mitaway Quick Strips or MACs for my hives. I am aware of problems that other beekeepers have had, but I also know that some of it was due to not following the guidance about applying it in the proper temperature range. I would also say, given what I heard, that one should not apply it in the upper temperature ranges that the product says is safe. I simply think it gases out too fast and does too much damage to the ecosystem of the hive. So the temperature range says you could apply it, I think, in the high 80s. As soon as you put it in there in the high 80s, it just completely nukes the hive. I think you want to do it in cooler weather. And I had contemplated taking today off because it was going to be 70 degrees, but it actually was going to be 80 degrees, which I thought was too high. And on Friday, it's actually only supposed to be in the low to mid 60s and no higher than 70, which I think, in my estimation, is a perfect time to apply MACs. So another thing that I've learned by watching and asking of those who have experience is that half doses make sense. In most cases, one should follow the label, and messing with doses and not applying the full amount is a complete and utter no-no, but even the manufacturer in this case is good with half-dose treatments. So some might be thinking, why not oxalic acid, which is the current darling? I suppose, and this sounds odd saying it, that I like to be a bit of a late adopter. I know people are using it successfully, but a few things are holding me back. One is, I don't have the equipment, and two, I would like to listen and observe how others make it work for them in the real world, here in New Jersey, and not by what I read. Because I know, it's being used as dribbles, it's being used in Canada. Even our friends in New Zealand are apropos with this. But I know that some in my region, in my area, are using it. In time, I'll learn what they did and what tweaks they made. And then I'll go forward with personal hands-on and hopefully start with a more sound approach in being a laggard. The same way that I am with Max. Max has been out for multiple seasons. I never tried it. I waited and learned and listened to the beekeepers around me. And now I think I have enough grasp on it to be able to apply it in my own hives without a tremendous amount of risk. Because listen, the last thing I want to do is lose all my bees. And this is simply me being me, it's still illegal. While that may not be a notion that bothers some people, I still consider that, well, a consideration. So I'm not going to do it. I mean, talking about oxalic, it's still not chartered for beekeeping use. So, Kevin moment. I talked about in the last episode or episode ago, two ago, about rhubarb and releasing oxalic. That, to me, is different than oxalic through vaporization or oxalic through drip or oxalic through shop towels, which, by the way, I'm still following and find absolutely fascinating. But again, I want to hear what people have to say about that. But rhubarb leaves or nettle or some of those other things, that's interesting to me. And that type of thing I think I might experiment with. Does that make me a bad person? Okay, so Mitaway Quick Strips. Their treatments are okay with honey supers on, so I got that going for me. And so if I get a quick ramp up on my hives while the max is still in there, which is only a 7-day treatment, I could still put my supers on. And if it gets any mites that are in the brood, well, that's an added bonus because it is one of those things that can penetrate capped brood. But still, my biggest concern, and I've heard several beekeepers say that even applied in favorable conditions, it still bombs the ecosystem and really sets the hive back. So for the first time, I'm going to use a product and find out for myself if it's going to be the case whether I had problems. It's a risk, and I don't like playing Russian roulette with my hives, and I think the risk is low, and I think I have enough practical experience in others that I think it'll be a viable treatment option. And I simply don't want to see people have an overdependence on Apivar, because I've heard a couple people saying, well, you know what, I'm just going to put Apivar in my hive again. You're supposed to rotate different treatments. And if I treated my hives in the fall with Apivar after the mite thresholds were too high, I'm not going to treat them again in the spring if the thresholds are dry. So I hope people are grasping that. Be Informed Partnership and others who are talking about that are trying to really make that sink into people. So if anything, there's one other thing to share about that. So another notion is that the commercial dependency on Ametraz and Tactic and the rumblings that it is impacting queen and becoming less effective. Tactic, spelled T-A-K-T-I-C, for those that don't know, is a commercial form of Ametraz formulated for ectoparasite control. And it's a commercial broad-spectrum control for mites, ticks, lice, and other commercial uses. It's specifically used in industry for things like cattle tick control, pig mange, sheep mange, and other indications. But it's not really supposed to be used for bees, which is why it's sort of a hush-hush, look-the-other-way thing for beekeeping and commercial beekeepers who have been accused of using this stuff. But the way the recent pendulum is swinging, it's starting to look unfavorably, meaning the regulatory agencies, at this practice in the commercial beekeeping industry. And simply overuse has led to lack of efficacy. And by the way, I understand that commercial beekeepers are being cracked down and people are being fined now, where in the past the agencies would look the other way. So the implications of Tactic could lead to future discussions about the effectiveness of Apivar, which is the layperson's version of Ametraz, and other options are going to have to be found. It's my understanding that Apivar, in its initial formulation, was ratcheted down in its dose of the effective chemical, and in time, it can be released in a stronger formulation if it starts to falter some, but eventually it's going to falter outright and become ineffective like some of the things that we've had in the past. So let me restate that again. Ametraz, which is going south in the commercial space, is the active ingredient in Apivar, and while they can ramp up Apivar to be a little bit stronger, eventually the prediction is it's going to go away, and we're going to lose that as a tool. So to that end, I'm watching with interest Randy Oliver's work with oxalic acid in the Shoptile delivery that he's experimenting with, but that's ongoing, and we'll let people who are leading get through that before we consider those options. In the meantime, I'll do my mite counts, and if the thresholds require it, I'll look to do my treatments here in the spring with Mite Away quick strips before the weather gets too warm. So before I close out this roundtable, I'll just add one thing, is that some folks who are brand new may have no idea what I'm talking about, mite thresholds and so on. I do recommend you go to Scientific Beekeeping website for Randy Oliver. Look that up. You'll find it anywhere. Any Google or Bing. And look up mite monitoring. He has a bunch of different articles on it. Varroa mites are the bane of our existence, and there are different techniques for monitoring mites to detect how many you have in your population. And when you reach a certain threshold, you should be treating. Another place to go look is the Bee Informed Partnership. Just a little public service announcement, because this time of year I tend to get a lot of new people listening, and I want to make sure that you're following along. Maybe I could have said that in the beginning of the segment, but now you kind of have the gist of what I've been talking about. Round table number 6, the local hive. In my travels, I maintain the Northwest New Jersey Beekeepers Association Facebook page, and just about every day I try to post something interesting to keep people engaged. You can subscribe to the page and you'll see things like news about industry practice, sometimes it's about research, sometimes it's news stories on beekeeping, beekeeping practices, and a lot about equipment and hives, because you know I have an interest in that if you're a regular listener. So sometimes I come across things, and I see a lot of things repeated, but sometimes I come across things that I've never seen before, and such is the case with this hive called the local hive. Let me see if I can describe the thing. And then a lot of times when you try to describe stuff like this verbally, it doesn't come out well. And I simply say to you, you can go to our show notes at bkcorner.org, show 108, and click on the link and see a picture, and you'll immediately grasp what it is I tried to describe if you didn't get it. First thing to note is the hive has two outer parts. The bottom of the hive resembles a fiber potting plant. I've seen these used in the past for swarm traps. Bob Kloss used them for a period of time, and I've seen them on Linda's bee blog. The top of the hive is a cap or a round dome. And you could picture, like, if you took a basketball and cut it in half, it's literally round, but it's bigger than a basketball by about 1.5 times. The overall dimension of this hive, which is meant to hang on a tree, let me just put that notion in your head, is about the size of an old-fashioned skep, or maybe if you've seen them, the sun hive. So the hive itself is made up of two shapes, an outer shell and an inner nested shell that sits inside of it. The top round dome and bottom part are made of interchangeable cork and it looks like plywood in the design. It's a cork round dome with a ring of wood and then cork round dome and then a ring. And then underneath is cork ring, cork ring, cork ring in a tapered shape that forms the bottom of the hive itself. The purpose of these rings interspersed into the cork is to, one, give a place for the frames to sit on, and two, create a substructure that holds the thing together, which I'll explain in a moment. So under the dome and above the bottom pot-shaped design is a circular hoop, a ring, made of plywood or some sort of wood. And on that are concentric half circles that vary in shape from small to large in a dome shape. And they nest inside underneath the dome. And they have a ridge by which the bees are supposed to build the comb to hang in the cavity below. What I didn't share is inside the outer shell is an inner shell made of a fiber product that looks something like egg carton material. And it's supposedly impregnated with some sort of mushroom material that the bees could use to spread healthy mushroom material inside the hive. Because recently there's been this thing about mushroom microbes that are supposed to create healthy ecosystems inside the hive, so it's incorporated into this build. So the nest chamber is constructed of this fiber-based material that's impregnated with mushroom spores, and it's referred to as the mushroom inner. It's 100% biodisposable liner that's impregnated with the spores, and as I said, the spores are spread around as the bees move around inside the hive. The internal chamber, this internal cocoon, is supported on four wooden slats that nest in the outer cork, and it creates this airspace from the inner cocoon to the outer cocoon. Sorry for the word cocoon, but I guess that kind of makes sense in description. So back to these wooden rings, they provide a bit of a skeletal backbone for the hive and are meant to attach the innovative wings that are also part of the design and sit outside of the hive. So the wings are just that. They're two wooden attachments that secure to the outside of the hive. And they resemble a flat stock piece that have cutouts in the panel that afford the ability to bungee cord the hive to a tree. So these flat panels appear to be 3/4 or 1 inch in thickness and are somewhat rectangular in shape on three sides. But the one long side has the contour so it nestles up against the overall hive and it connects with those rings that make up the skeletal area. The nature of the wings is that they rest against the tree. So you set the hive against the tree and the wings go to the left and right behind it and you take bungee cords through the holes in the panels and you go around the tree and that's what holds this thing to a tree. So to me, it's very similar to the way you would hang a swarm trap, but this is supposed to be meant a hive that bees take up residence hanging against a tree that's up in the air. So not for nothing, that's a pretty ingenious way of attaching something to a tree, which is always a challenge if you've ever tried it. So there's a couple design sensibilities that talk about. For instance, the cork substrate was chosen because it's a natural insulator, and it also is supposed to dampen any noise. My guess is, given the shape, it's an engineered look of a hive that its components are composite, and the hive looks finished, meaning industrial to me, but yet it's a bit prototype-like because the rings they use were made of plywood or laminated wood pieces, and I would assume in wet conditions that the laminate will delaminate and the hive will fall apart, and I don't know how cork holds up in the... I always thought cork would absorb water, and I'm not sure how the substrates would work, but again, it's a prototype design. I'm not sure if the intention is to paint this thing or waterproof it in some manner. It doesn't indicate any of that in the design. And I'm going to go and be kind of harsh for a second. It looks like it was designed by a design student who doesn't know beekeeping. That's my initial take on it. But yet there's some interesting design aspects that I found, interesting. So, you know, What's bad about that? I love the ingenuity of it, and I find it amazing that people continue to conjure up new ideas to keep bees. And the wing fastening design, I thought, was really innovative, and alone, it could be inspiration for others who have to hang swarm traps, for examples. So the person who invented it, his name is Will Jordan, and I say kudos to him. And keep going with your project. If you look, I'm sure people, I've already seen some people bashing this design and saying it's dumb and da-da-da-da. But stop it, people. Let's let the kid develop, or the person, gentleman, young man, designer, whatever term we want to use. Because I think it's cool stuff, and I wish him a lot of good luck. And I hope he succeeds with it. So check it out. We'll have a link on our show notes, and you'll get to see what it looks like. And who knows, maybe this will evolve to be the replacement for our Langstroth homes. Never know, folks. Never know. So that's going to wrap it up for what I had prepared. I have a couple odds and ends to end out the episode. The first one is small hive beetle control. We talked about microfiber cloth on a couple episodes. Someone mentioned to me recently that you could use Swiffer duster cloths. Just fluff them up a little bit and it traps hive beetles. So you might want to give that a try if hive beetles have been a problem. Wanted to acknowledge Dale. You wrote in about discussion of observation hives. That's an interesting topic. Thanks for sending that along. We'll see what we can put in. Found a really cool one to talk about. Wanted to give a shout out to Christy Moskowitz. Christy, your question, can you start a nuke in one hive and a package in another? Or do you think the difference in size will make one rob the other? The answer to that is keep them both closed so that each hive can defend and they should be fine living side by side. Especially if you're putting them out with plenty of forage, then they'll be preoccupied with making bigger and not pecking on each other. I appreciate your comments that you laugh out loud. My wife was reading the email on my phone when it popped in and thought that was kind of funny. And I've had that reference of disc jockey Chris Stevens from Northern Exposure. I'll have to go listen to that. That's there's been multiple times when people have said that to me, so I'm not sure what that's about, but yeah, thanks for writing in. So like our beloved bees, when beekeepers go together, we accomplish great things. Thanks everyone for listening, and catch you next time on the Beekeeper's Corner podcast.